been listening to A Little More Conversation. I'm Ben O'Hara Byrne. On this Monday night, he watched and pleaded for help as the horrors of the Rwandan genocide unfolded in front of his eyes on his watch as UN commander. As we mark 30 years since that atrocity, retired Lieutenant General Romeo Dallaire builds on that experience in a new book called The Peace. He joins me to share his story. Iran launched an unprecedented direct attack on Israel over the weekend, launching drones and missiles. Almost all of them failed to reach their targets or were shot down. So as Israel contemplates a response, allies including Canada and the U.S. are calling for tensions to be scaled back. Will Israel listen? Can it afford to? We find out. April is Parkinson's Awareness Month. The neurological disorder affects more than 100,000 Canadians, and it is the fastest growing neurological disease on the planet. My longtime Chorus colleague, Larry Gifford, was diagnosed with young onset Parkinson's in August of 2017 in his mid-40s. He's with me to talk about living with Parkinson's, the impacts of something that he underwent 6 months ago called deep brain stimulation surgery, and much more. But first, we head to Manhattan, where history was made on Monday as Donald Trump became the first former president to stand criminal trial. He's accused of falsifying internal Trump Organization records as part of a scheme to bury stories about an affair with porn star Stormy Daniels. He feared would hurt his 2016 campaign. We find out what's at stake, how long this trial could take, what the punishment could be if he's found guilty, and why it's already proving so hard to find jurors. As jury selection got underway in the hush money case of Donald Trump, he's become the first president or former president to stand trial on criminal charges. Jurors will hear the case charging him with falsifying business records in order to stifle stories about his relationship with adult film star Stormy Daniels. Finding a jury, though, could prove pretty challenging. The judge today excused the majority of the first group of prospective jurors after they admitted they just couldn't be fair and impartial. Now, we spoke with Bloomberg's Frank Wilkinson about this historic trial on Friday, and he was quick to point out just how difficult it would be to find jurors.
I don't know how you find a jury anywhere in the United States, let alone in Manhattan, that doesn't have very powerful opinions about Donald Trump and whether he is guilty or innocent of a lot of things. So that's going to be a complicated piece of the business that the judge is really going to have to work through, and I'm not sure how that comes out.
Yeah, well, on day one, zero. Mind you, it started quite late in the day. They're going to resume tomorrow, apparently. Now, someone who always has opinions, of course, Donald Trump told reporters at the end of the day that the judge isn't allowing him to miss any court sessions, and that means missing some important events to him.
I can't go to my son's graduation, or that I can't go to the United States Supreme Court, that I'm not in Georgia or Florida or North Carolina campaigning like I should be. It's perfect for the radical left Democrats. That's exactly what they want. If you read all of the legal pundits, all of the legal scholars today, there's not one that I see that said this is a case that should be brought or tried. It's a scam. It's a political witch hunt.
Yeah, I'm not sure what legal scholars he was reading, but nonetheless, there he is, Donald Trump, and his opinions on this trial that began today. The former U.S. president, of course, a reminder, is accused of falsifying internal Trump Organization records as part of a scheme to bury stories he feared would hurt his 2016 campaign. Tim Backett is professor of law at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. He's author of a book called The Plea of Innocence, Restoring Truth to the American Justice System, and he joins me now. Tim, thanks for your time tonight.
Ben, good evening. Thank you.
This is quite the trial. I mean, it was interesting to talk about it in the lead up to it, but to actually see him sitting there today, kind of hammered home, both the kind of mundane nature of the trial itself and the incredible sort of groundbreaking nature of it at the same time.
Yes, it is mundane and momentous at the same time. It's in a courtroom that a lot of people would describe as not very inviting, and certainly a place that's not very inviting with regard to the jurors and Mr. Trump. One of the things that you mentioned, Ben, was that the judge excused a number of jurors today. I think the number was 50 out of 96, because those 50 raised their hands and said that they could not be fair to Mr. Trump. I think that's somewhat concerning, because that's, in essence, people saying that despite what the judge told me the law is and how I should listen to the evidence and not view Mr. Trump as a personality, that the jurors nonetheless have said, at least in day one, 50 of them, that they can't be fair to Mr. Trump under any circumstances, and they were dismissed. That is not a good indicator for Mr. Trump when in New York County, a lot of people call it Manhattan, but in essence it is New York County, where he's being tried, the Democrats outnumber the Republicans 9-1, about 780,000 to 85,000, and those are the jurors who are going to be sitting on his case.
Yeah, maybe explain that a bit, because in this case, I mean, I think most people understand how a jury is selected. They're looking for 12 here and six alternates. But right off the bat, it seemed like they were going to have a very hard time finding those. So what happened? I mean, did they just keep looking till they can agree on those 18?
Figuratively, and it's not really much different in substance than being at a McDonald's restaurant anywhere in Canada, the United States, and putting into the restaurant first 90 people who are the jurors, and then saying that the judge is standing behind the counter saying that when they raise their hands and say that they can't be fair to someone in McDonald's, he throws 50 of them out, and then he'll bring 50 more in. Today, he got to the point where among the 40 or so jurors who remain, he was able to question some of them, ask them specific questions, they answer the questions, and they are temporarily inside the jury box. That is to say, they're still being considered, but no decision has been made on whether they will, in fact, serve in the end. The process will go on. I've seen some reports that indicate it will go on for 2 weeks, which is an exceptionally long period of time. But given what happened today, I don't see that 2 weeks will necessarily be enough. It might be, but it's somewhat concerning, as I said, that we have this number of jurors who, despite their animosity apparently for Mr. Trump, are in essence saying that they're unable to follow the judge's instructions on looking at the evidence only and not the personality.
Right. Interesting. I mean, I've watched juries, you know, I've watched reselection in very big trials before, and there are a fair number who simply don't want to have to sit through it, right? They don't want to have to do it. So they'll put their hand up. I guess at some point the judge may have to sort of lay down the law a bit, so to speak.
In some instances, one kind of analog that we could look at, or maybe two, is in other cases. In an organized crime case, for example, some jurors will not want to sit because they fear being threatened. In another kind of case, a sexual assault case, many jurors will feel uncomfortable listening to the evidence from the complainant and having to reach a verdict on whether the defendant is guilty or innocent. Those kinds of cases are very different. Those kinds of recusal jurors are very different than in this case, what happened today, because in those events, the jurors are saying, we can't judge because of the nature of the case. The Trump case, in contrast, is very non-controversial, aside from the politics. That is, he's accused of making false statements and documents and encouraging others in an organization to do so. What the jury today seems to be saying is that we cannot judge Mr. Trump as a person solely because of his political affiliations and the things that he's done and said, and they're unwilling to say that they and follow what the judge instructs them to do.
We're talking about a first. History was made today. The first former president to stand criminal trial. His trial, Donald Trump's, began in New York City today, this morning. There was actually jury selection this afternoon that didn't go very well. They've yet to find a juror. It continues tomorrow. Of course, this is the hush money case, the Stormy Daniels case. Tim Bakken is with us. He's a professor of law at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. His book is called The Plea of Innocence, Restoring Truth to the American Justice System. Tim, just this trial itself, because of the four, this seems to be the one, I mean, it's getting a lot of attention because of where it is and some of the salacious details around it, but it seemed like the least of the four, and yet it's the one that's gone to trial, and clearly Donald Trump has his thoughts about just how legitimate this all is.
It's certainly the least serious of the four cases because the maximum sentence in this case is a year and a third in prison to 4 years in prison. But in all likelihood, even if there's a conviction, President Trump will probably not be sentenced to prison as a first offender, and somebody
who, despite what some might say, has contributed to the country. But the charges themselves, while they're not unique, they're unique in their application. That is, in most instances, filing false business documents will be accompanied by other charges that deal with enterprise corruption or business dealings that have gone awry in some way. But in this instance, the main charge is filing a false business document against Mr. Trump. In one sense, the district attorney had to reach to find this charge because it is a misdemeanor, and it could only be prosecuted if it could somehow be elevated to a felony. And the way he prosecuted it in this instance to elevate it to a felony was to say that the filing of the false business document was done to support the allegation that he was trying to cover up the sexual affair with Stormy Daniels. So in that instance, as you said, Ben, it is a bit salacious, and there will be a lot of, in essence, Mr. Trump's past sexual peccadilloes coming into evidence in this case because of what the judge decided today. He said, for example, that a woman named Karen McDougal, with whom Mr. Trump is alleged to have had a relationship, will be able to testify about their relationship. He also allowed the prosecution to introduce evidence about Mr. Trump's statement about women that was shown on Access Hollywood. That is, mm-hmm. the prosecutor will be able to read in the statement, but the videotape of the statement will not be able to be shown. It has the possibility of going in many directions because Mr. Trump, if McDougal, for example, is allowed to testify, and if the statement to Access Hollywood is allowed to be introduced into evidence, Mr. Trump will have the opportunity to say that the statement was made in jest, and you can argue about that, and that Ms. McDougal is not telling the truth, and you can argue about that. But the point is, those kinds of allegations and counter-allegations and denials and assertions will have to be contested in court, which will lengthen the trial and will take a focus off the really mundane charge, filing a false business document.
Yeah. Interesting, too, that that the judge today told him he's going to have to, I gather, have to be there for the whole thing. He's going to have to sit and watch the whole thing. Apparently today he dozed off ever so briefly. But, you know, this is not necessarily where obviously either of the two presidential candidates wants to be at this point in time, sitting in a courtroom in New York.
Yes, it does seem like a disadvantage to Mr. Trump in his quest for the presidency. But in this case, the judge is probably on solid legal ground because not only do defendants have a right to a fair trial, but also the government, and in this case, New York State, has a right to a fair trial. And part of that includes a defendant being present at court and standing up to his or her accusers and being present to hear what's happening. And then that helps satisfy the state that it has provided a fair trial to Mr. Trump and any defendant in those kinds of situations. And so it's very unlikely that Mr. Trump will be excused. There was one instance that the judge seemed to equivocate and say that Mr. Trump might even have to be there for the entire trial and not be able to attend his son's graduation. My sense is that that will be changed and he'll be allowed to attend the son's graduation and the trial will just not continue on that day. There's one other disadvantage to Mr. Trump, and that is the rest days, the off days for the trial are Wednesdays, which will prevent him from traveling on weekends and using three-day weekends to campaign in other parts of the country.
Right. Also, I understand the judge, there's some issues around what he's been saying publicly about the judge, right? He's been essentially bashing the judge on his Truth Social media accounts and so on. So that's going to come up too, I think, next week.
You're right. As I see it, and I read about it today, it seems that the judge is withholding a decision on whether to fine President Trump or to take any kind of sanction against him for those kinds of comments which would be in violation of the judge's order. And I have to emphasize that when trials are conducted in any place, especially places like the common law countries, England, Canada, New Zealand, United States, Australia, it's the defendant, of course, who has a right to a fair trial, but also the government has a right to a fair trial. And therefore, Mr. Trump, while he has exceedingly high interest in, of course, avoiding a conviction and imprisonment and also trying his best to be reelected to the presidency, the state, the people, have an equally high interest in ensuring that a procedure is devoid of histrionics and is focused in the end on the law, so that once there's a verdict, we'll know that the verdict was decided on the basis of law and not on the basis of personality. That's a difficult thing to do in this case, but it nonetheless should be the goal of the judge.
Yeah, it's going to be quite the next few weeks. Tim, thank you so much for your time tonight.
Thank you, Ben.
Chrystia Freeland today, the finance minister, deputy prime minister, put on those new pairs of shoes, or a new pair of shoes for the cameras. That is that long-standing tradition the day before the finance minister presents that federal budget. Again, the Liberals have made no secret of what's going to be in it, a focus on housing, a focus on affordability. And the only details tomorrow, really, are how they plan to pay for everything, right? Here is, by the way, here's Chrystia Freeland getting those shoes on today.
Okay, great. Comfortable. A little bit of a heel. Yeah. A smaller person maybe is helped by that. And also really comfortable.
Right. Her shoes may be comfortable, but a number of Canadians, in fact, a majority polled by Angus Reid, are a little bit uncomfortable right now with the amount of money they think the government's about to spend on some of these priority items that they have. Economists are saying that tax hikes are on the table as well. There's a big article about that in the Globe and Mail today, because how exactly are you going to pay for these new programs without running up the deficit even more unless you raise taxes? So again, the age-old question, is it worth it? And where's this money going to come from? And are you spending it on the right stuff, right? Now, for the Liberals, it's obvious. They're way down in the polls, and you know they need to find some way to catch up in. And the only way to do that in some ways is to address the issues they think that are really hurting them in the polls, and namely affordability, right? They're trying to bring back those younger voters who seem to have drifted. I was talking to someone yesterday who said she had voted for Trudeau twice, or voted for the Liberals twice, I should say, in 2015 and in 2019 and 2021, and will not do so again because of affordability and cost of living issues. So those are the people that they're trying to get back. And of course, it's ever so tempting to use a budget to try to turn that around. So we'll see what's in it tomorrow, but we thought we'd try and figure out first what it is that Canadians have told pollsters that they do and don't want to see in this budget. And what it boils down to, in a nutshell, really, is they don't really want to see the government spending beyond its means for any reason. They do think there should be priority areas where money should be spent, but they don't want to see them spending money like, you know, like it's going out of style. And of course, that's kind of the reputation that this government has had for quite some time. Now, Shachi Curl is president of the Angus Reid Institute, and she joins me now. Shachi, thank you so much.
Thanks. Hi.
Yeah, this is going to be an interesting budget tomorrow, because a lot of people are watching it for mainly to see how much they're going to spend and how they're going to account for that spending, or at least, you know, try to not plunge further into deficit. You went out to ask Canadians what they wanted out of this budget, and don't spend too much seemed to be the popular answer.
You know, it's an interesting thing, because it's often sort of what follows. Is it the public that taps into that, oh, we're spending too much sentiment, or is it political leaders who start banging that drum, and then all of a sudden everyone's like, yeah, it does feel like too much. But there is a significant consensus here, or 60% of Canadians saying that they think the levels of government spending are too much right now. When you break that down, however, there are some key and significant findings. It's not going to surprise anybody that nearly 90% of current conservative voters, 87% exactly of them, think that the Trudeau government is spending too much. I've chronicled all of this in my Post Media column this week, but you also see it within the ranks of Bloc voters. And usually the Bloc Québécois voters, when you look at that sort of right-left spectrum on politics, you know, they tend to be on a lot of other issues, whether it's climate change or other issues, more aligned with where Liberal voters are at, not on the issue of deficit spending, however. And then even 40%, that's a big chunk of NDP voters, are at a place where they think Ottawa is spending too much. and so too did nearly one in three liberal voters. So again, it's not the same amount across the political spectrum, but when you look at the places that are natural support bases for the federal liberals, the liberals themselves, the NDP, the Bloc, you are seeing big numbers of people who are saying, hold on, we're a little bit worried about all this spending.
What about those? And one of the things that popped up out of your survey that was interesting was those who had voted liberal in 2021 now probably aren't. And they're watching this one closely. And you'd think that's exactly the kind of people that the party needs to attract back, right? That's who they're looking to attract back. And you were saying that even they are looking at this and saying, yeah, don't spend too much.
The conservatives under Pierre Poilievre, like Pierre Poilievre or not, and don't get me wrong, there's a lot of Canadians who don't like him. But that said, he and the party have done a very effective job of eating the Liberals' lunch on what I would call pocketbook issues. So cost of living and inflation. Huge issue for Liberals who voted Liberal in 2021 but are not voting Liberal if an election were held in the near term or in the short term. Same thing on government spending, same thing on carbon tax. The issue is that while the dwindling size of the Liberal base is staying with the Prime Minister and this government on their policies, there's a whole bunch who have just drifted away, gone away. They're not there anymore. And they're either drifting to the Conservatives or drifting to the NDP. But again, even NDP voters are concerned about the amount of spending that they're seeing.
And yet, when you ask people what the needs were, we talk about healthcare, we talk about a whole raft of things that seem like they're in trouble. People do expect spending to be made there. It's an interesting dichotomy. So when you look at people who are opposed to any increases in spending, what would they like to, how do they suggest these other things get fixed? Or did you ask?
No, we did ask. And again, I hate to say it, but politics is a big driver of where to cut. So there is some amount of consensus around healthcare spending. Canadians, regardless of political stripes, say, well, if we've got to spend, that's an area that we'd like to see more spending. You do see that also with notably defense spending. That is something that there are enough voters across the political spectrum who say, look, either because Donald Trump is out there threatening to not show up with the cavalry as a NATO ally for countries that aren't spending their 2% of GDP, or because they're noticing deficiencies within Canada's defense spending as it stands today, you've got a challenge around defense spending, and that's something that needs to be bolstered. But then when you get into other issues around, well, what should take priority, all of a sudden, again, politics really does tell the story. And so when you look at issues and program spending on climate change, for example, big political dichotomy. The right says cut spending on that. The left says keep it, maintain it, increase it. Same thing on areas around reconciliation, other anti-poverty measures. These are things that the left of center and centrist voters say, no, we want to continue to see spending in this area. The right of center says, kill it, because they don't agree, they don't see the point, or they're worried about taxation in terms of what's coming for them. So what we're going to find out on Tuesday, of course, is whether there are new taxes announced. And who gets taxed and how that changes the dynamics or the dichotomy of all of this. Economists and those who are defending the government spending will say, look, our spending to GDP ratio as a percentage of GDP is not as high as it's been, say, in the 1980s or 90s or even during the pandemic. There are others who say it doesn't matter what the percentage is. At the end of the day, it's a certain number of dollars that are going to have to be paid back at a time where interest rates are rising. So just in the same way that mortgage rates are going up and people are having to find other ways to pay for that, well, you know, debt servicing at the federal level also is dependent on interest rates.
So that sounds like quite the balancing act for the Prime Minister or for the Finance Minister tomorrow, because they're going to have to convince people that the spending is worthwhile. Although they've already announced most of it, we know it's going to be tens of billions. But they're also tomorrow going to have to convince people that it's sustainable. And that's going to be the tough one. And I think you wrote about this saying, you're not sure they can meet any of the things they're going to have to meet tomorrow.
They've got to reassure people and say it's sustainable. They've got to get them excited about the prospect of, hey, we're spending this money, it might benefit you. They've got to be able to not just get them excited, but excited enough to vote for them. And as I wrote, and to your point, I really get the sense now, and we're going to keep polling. I mean, maybe the needle will move, but I just get the sense that the Canadians are now just covering their ears, and they've tuned out to some extent to what this government is saying, which is not uncommon when you've got a government that's been in power coming on 9 years.
Yeah, especially a government that all of a sudden starts to point at problems that exist out there as if they had nothing to do, had no opportunity to solve them earlier. Now, you know, there's lots of other things that have happened over the last 8 years, but nonetheless, it's difficult for a government that's been in, that's looking to win a fourth election to say, oh, these things need to be fixed and we're the ones who can do it, even though we haven't done it over the last 8.5 years.
Governments that are long in the tooth, even if the hits just keep coming and they're in reactive mode and dealing at times with issues that are either not of their making or made worse on their watch, but not necessarily of their own worsening. It's, you know, at some point people just say, you've had this long to fix it. Why haven't you fixed it yet? And in a change election, whether it's from conservative to liberal or liberal to conservative or from one party to another party, it is almost usually and certainly just the fact that people are, they're fatigued. And the Trudeau fatigue factor is there, but it's also just a sense that they may well be running out of road in order to turn things around on interest rates, on inflation, on housing affordability, even on healthcare. The dollars that have been flowing out of Ottawa, either directly or indirectly, to the provinces and into communities are going to take a handful of years, if not decades, to actually come to a point where Canadians are seeing it and experiencing the relief or the benefit of it in their day-to-day lives.
Shachi Curl, president of the Angus Reid Institute, is with us this half hour. We were just talking polling and politics. Let's talk about something lighter now. Shachi, I always love this survey because it comes out and it's about Canadians and the playoffs. So we have, again, this year, four teams, Canadian teams, will be in the playoffs. All of them have 100 points. They all had good years. But tell me what Canadians are thinking. It looks like this time, more than ever, people are actually cheering for any Canadian team to win the Cup.
More so than in past years. I think every year that the north of the border drought continues, of course, we all know it's been a generation and a half.
Man,
Ben, we
I was in university.
So young. I hadn't even graduated high school.
I know.
1993. When Savard lifted the cups for the half back in that 92-93 dream season. And, you know, the Canucks went all the way the next year, and it seemed like, or the year after, I don't think anyone in that moment realized that this would be the last time a Canadian team hoisted the Stanley Cup. Now, there's a big difference between Canadian teams and Canadian players, because, of course, all of our Canadian players are hoisting the Cup just for U.S. teams year over year
playing
now.
In Vegas and so on. But it was interesting to see. So a lot of Canadians are wanting to see a Canadian team. I think it was about two-thirds say it doesn't matter which team as long as it's a Canadian
team. That's right. But that said, they have some very definite views about who they think will be the team to break the streak. And what's notable about that is the regionalism around this gets pretty intense, because cover your ears, people in Ontario and East, but the fact is that there are just more choices to choose from in Western Canada. The Canucks are going to the playoffs. The Oilers are going to the playoffs. The Jets are going to the playoffs. These are like salad days for Western Canadian teams. When you look at who's cheering for who, what happens Ontario East, because the Leafs are an original Big Six, original six team, you've got a situation wherein a lot of folks in Atlantic Canada who would otherwise maybe be cheering for Boston or New York, you know, they're going to back the Maple Leafs, because the Maple Leafs are a team in a region of the country that skews older, who would say, well, I remember watching the Leafs growing up. They don't have the same relationship with some of these newer teams. Even though it's really hard to think about the Oilers and their dynasty in the 80s as a newer team, it doesn't go all the way back to the 50s and 60s then. So you see more support not only in Ontario. 77% of Ontarians think that it will be the Leafs.
77%.
That
wow,
breaks the streak.
Makes sense.
Yeah, 70%. Yeah. But you've also got big chunks in Atlantic Canada, nearly half there, also a significant number in Quebec. In BC, 83% of British Columbians say it's, of course, going to be their beloved Canucks that break that streak.
Right.
In Winnipeg and in all of Manitoba, it's 86% who say their beloved Winnipeg Jets are going to break the streak. And, of course, Alberta, it's an interesting dichotomy because you've got a lot of those Oilers fans, but it's not necessarily Flames fans who are like, oh, yeah, we're going to back the Oilers now, because that rivalry is so strong with the Battle of Alberta.
Yeah, interesting that last I looked at the standings, the Canucks and the Jets actually have more points than the Oilers and the Leafs in the regular season. But it's the Oilers and the Leafs that most Canadians think stand the best chance at about 20%.
You know, never question the opinions of Canadians. It is my job to simply measure them and reflect them back to the rest of the country and say, this is what people think. I always try to check my bias the minute I open up those data files. But in this case, Ben, I am going to unabashedly say, go Canucks, go.
Indeed. My Habs, my Canadians, they won the last one. But I said I wouldn't complain about hockey for a decade after they won the last cup. And here we are 31 years later. And we're still
31 years later.
There you go. There are
What happened first? Did Friends air or did the Habs win the cup? I mean, we're talking about a long time ago.
It is. Like 93 is an awfully long time ago. Shachi, thank you so much as always.
Thanks for having me.
When we think of Parkinson's disease in this country, we'll often think of Michael J. Fox, of course, who's been such a vocal advocate to try and raise awareness about it. But in reality, more than 115,000 Canadians have been diagnosed with the neurological disorder. 10 million people plus around the world have as well. That number has doubled in just 25 years. So in this century alone, it's expected to double again by 2040. It is the fastest growing neurological disease on the planet. It does not discriminate, as you well know, by gender, sex, ethnicity, age, or geography. About 10% of people with Parkinson's are diagnosed in their 40s or younger. And of course, there is no cure. Dopamine, essentially, movement is controlled by dopamine, right? This is a pretty unscientific explanation, but movement is controlled by dopamine, a chemical that carries that signal between the nerves and the brain. When cells that normally produce it die, the symptoms of Parkinson's start to appear. So we have a decent understanding of what's going on, but we don't know how to cure it. We do know, in some senses, how to try to alleviate some of the symptoms. Parkinson's Awareness Month is April, right? Last Thursday, the 11th, was World Parkinson's Day. It's always held on the 11th because that marks the birth in 1755 of Dr. James Parkinson. It's been more than 200 years since he published his research on what was called then shaky palsy and was later renamed Parkinson's disease. So that's why it's on the 11th, and that's why April is Parkinson's Awareness Month. And again, time to sort of raise awareness, promote a greater understanding of the condition, how it can affect people, who it affects, what treatments are available. My next guest, of course, is a special one because he's been on the show to talk about this before and on other Chorus shows. A longtime Chorus colleague and all-around great guy, Larry Gifford, was diagnosed with young-onset Parkinson's in August of 2017 at the age of 45. He's since become a very vocal advocate, raising awareness about the neurodegenerative disease through a group called PD Avengers, which he co-founded and is president of to this day, podcasting and serving with other Parkinson's advocacy groups as well. Here is Larry talking a bit about the good and the bad of that diagnosis.
I feel Parkinson's has been a gift in that it's shown me how much love and support that I have from my wife and my son and my family and my friends that we probably all have, but we don't know it until we need it.
Indeed. And of course, because there is no cure, the search is always on for relief from some of the symptoms. And just 6 months ago, Larry underwent something called deep brain stimulation surgery, or DBS. And it's been about 6 months. So we want to bring Larry on tonight to talk about World Parkinson's Awareness Month or Parkinson's Awareness Month and to tell us a bit more about how he's doing 6 months after the DBS. Larry, thank you. Welcome back.
It's good to be here. My favorite place to be.
Absolutely. How have you been? I mean, last we sort of were in touch, this was about 6 months ago when the DBS process was beginning. I obviously follow you on social media and on LinkedIn and elsewhere, so I kind of know. But how did it all work out? How was it?
It was great. It was totally good.
Oh, good.
I went back to my neurologist today for the first time in 14 months, and he said, you are great. He goes, when we tested you the first time you were here on this, on the Parkinson's scale, it's got a big name acronym, but on the Parkinson's scale, I was a 10 when I was diagnosed. Last time I was there, I was at 27, now I'm at 9.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so I'm better than I was before I was diagnosed.
How just so I suppose so listeners would understand the symptoms and then how one goes from sort of the situation getting worse to it getting better.
So it's basically you hit the nail on the head. It's all about dopamine and dopamine replacement for me. So before surgery, I was up to 18 to 20 pills a day of just dopamine replacement. So every 2.5 hours, or every 2 hours, I had 2.5 pills. Well, that's a lot. And it disrupts your lifestyle and everything else. DBS is meant to sustain you at your, and with pills, you're on and you're off. So you can feel like the ramp up to the pill taking hold. It takes about 20 minutes. And then about a half hour before your next pill, you can feel the drop off. With DBS, it's an electric current from almost like a pacemaker over your heart. But it's for your brain, and it sends electric signals. And so there's no on and off. It's just a constant steady stream, and I feel great. My walking is not, it's stronger than it used to be. Like, I don't walk with my poles anymore, but my balance is off. So I'm bumping into things. So we've got to adjust a little bit for that. But other than that, it's remarkable. It's truly, for me, I think I got the sweet spot because I had the longest, what they call the honeymoon that they had ever seen, which is right after the surgery, before they turn you on, because they've been in your brain, you're starting to feel the effects of something happening and your brain reacting to it before they actually turn the device on. And I had that for 8 weeks. So they couldn't turn me on until January after having surgery in October.
Wow. Because I had read, so I think you, this is you, you talked about, I think it was 7,665 pills a year was sort of how, what it added up to. And that has, you've been able to reduce that now with this?
I'm down to 2 pills a day.
Wow.
Half pill every 6 hours. Isn't that amazing?
Now I get, it is. No, that is absolutely, because I was reading up, obviously before I spoke to you, I was reading up about DBS because I knew a little bit about it, but not much, right? I mean, there's been some stuff with Elon Musk recently about sort of that kind of idea of stimulating the brain that way. But I gather it's not available to everyone and it's not offered to everyone. But in your case, it seemed to have been something that was needed and worked, which is amazing.
Yeah, they take you through a day of psychological analysis and then they take you through, you have to go off your meds for 12 hours to make sure that the medication itself, because if the medication doesn't work for you, this won't work for you. And right. what they look for is a 40% increase from your on to off state while on pills. So I went off for 12 hours and it was like I was 78 years old.
Yeah.
And I'm not 78 years old. I don't know if you know that or not.
Yes. I think you posted some pictures. There's a video of it, right? About
there
you
is,
off
yeah.
and on. And it was jar. I mean, it so drove home the impact that it has. It really did. Because
yes.
I mean, we've met. I just didn't know. Like, you don't know until you see, right?
Yeah. Well, and so many, think about all the people that are walking around today that are dealing with this stuff. So much of it's invisible too.
Yeah.
And and it's growing. I mean, I was talking to my neurologist today. They just hired their 9th neurologist over at UBC. And he goes, we're running out of room. We're like the onslaught of DBS. And he talked about the doubling of DBS in the next, 15 years or whatever. They're feeling the pinch now.
I remember back in October when you went to go, anytime someone says I'm going in and you use the sort of the term brain surgery, regardless of what it is, it always sounds ominous, scary. But in this case, it seems to have really made a huge difference. And I suppose part of this is trying
Doesn't
to expand.
Make it less scary than...
No, I wouldn't think so.
It was scary. Trust me.
Yeah. And for your family too, right? I mean,
well, yeah, I mean, it's the, let me just tell you very briefly what they did. They screwed, basically I had to have a cage over my head to screw to the surgery table so I wouldn't move my head. And so they screwed those through my skin into my skull with screws while I was awake. Like, just like, I don't know if they went to the hardware store or what. They got out their Husqvarna, which is a drill. And they
you're awake for this. Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah. I'm awake the whole time. And they just have local anesthetic because they can't give me pills because I have to be normal. I have to be at my normal so they know if it's responding correctly. And so, yeah, it's harrowing and devastating and thrilling and curious all at the same time. But I think the thing that got me the most, Ben, was when the drill was going and it pushed through to the inside of the brain cavity. You felt the air rush out. That was wild.
Wow. And then you just, I mean, you just, how do you recover from, what's the recovery like?
I went home the next day, didn't have a headache, no problem. I had like 30 stitches and a couple, you know, and so I had to watch those for a couple of weeks. They took the stitches out. And then I went in once a week for programming. So they would program this device that I have, which is basically, it's a Galaxy phone on steroids and has a big modem to it that connects to the doctor. And I can actually increase my electricity whenever I want to decrease it.
Oh, wow.
Up to a point. Like, I can't like go, they're not going to give me too much to play with. But you know, I've got a reasonable amount. And then, so over the course of time, they just keep bumping that up and taking my pills away and lowering my medication. And so it's, wow. it just worked perfectly. It doesn't work this way for everybody, certainly. And I'm not saying that everybody should do it. You should just, something that you should talk to doctors about if you have Parkinson's and you want relief from whether it's tremor or any of your movement symptoms. And then there's always, they'll never guarantee it, but there's always some non-motor symptoms that are relieved as well.
And this was, and you found you're better than when you were first diagnosed, and you're down to two pills a day from 18 to 20.
Yeah, it's remarkable.
It must be such, I mean, I don't think, I wouldn't even know where to begin to understand what it's like to have to take pills that often and how much it disturbs the way you live your life.
Well, and I have so much energy now. And my son's like, Dad, you've got so much energy now. Like, oh, wow. When my son starts to notice things like that, you know, that's great. I'm walking. Yeah.
Walking more, exercise. Getting around. Yeah.
Yeah. It's great.
That's amazing. You didn't know that going in, right? I mean, I remember when we spoke beforehand. You didn't know that. It was just something you were going to try because it was time to try it.
I had to. I mean, because I was at a point there where it wasn't sustainable anymore. My life was becoming miserable. And I was getting to those stages of apathy and depression and lots of anxiety. And I don't have that anymore.
Larry, interesting to see another sort of more high-profile Canadian in Martha Johnson sort of coming out and putting out this song and sort of talking about light, to try and destigmatize in some ways what life can be, even though, as you've pointed out many times, it can be very difficult. But in her case, trying to show that there's lots that you can still do.
Oh, yeah. And I'm so, so grateful she did that. Even the background singers all had Parkinson's. I mean, right. she did it right. And it's a cool song. I was doing a live stream for 24 hours on Thursday, and we helped debut that song. So that was good.
Wow.
But the other thing is I think we need to be clear about is this is a degenerative progressive disease. So I'm not going to be like this forever. So, but what they have the opportunity to do is chase the disease with the technology. So they'll change it and they can adapt once they put the electrodes in my head, you can adapt them. So they go to different targets. And then, so they can, if my speech gets bad, they can turn it towards that so it improves, or they can And then if there's brand new treatments come in, let's say gene therapy, they can just layer it in on top of what I already have. So it's pretty cool.
You know, I think the first time we spoke about this on air was probably 2 years ago. I think it was April 11th, 2022. How much has changed in the last 2 years? I know for you, much has changed, especially with this surgery. But how much more do we know? Do you feel optimism about where we're headed?
I do. What's changed a lot is back when we spoke 2 years ago, there was no such thing as a biomarker, which is a test for Parkinson's. And we now have about five different tests that are in the works. They're not widely used yet, but there's about five options now: blood test, spinal fluid test, sebum test. There's also all these tests. They're now out there being tested. And so I think we're going to have a couple of biomarkers before the end of the year, which is great, because without that, if you can't tell me I have Parkinson's, you can't measure my Parkinson's. And so you have to be able to measure something before you can cure. So we hope what this will do is once you've identified Parkinson's, then hopefully maybe we'll identify it when you don't have any symptoms at all. And we can catch it before it onsets, before the symptoms appear, and we can isolate it in your body so you don't get Parkinson's.
Right. And the awareness part of it, yeah, that would be the key. And the awareness, it just feels like each year that there is more awareness about it. Maybe it's because I follow you all over social media, so I see what you're doing. But it just felt like this year there was a lot of talk about it. There was a lot of blue out there. There was the song that came out. It just felt like there was another push again this year to try and raise awareness about this. And it felt like it has been successful. I mean, I know there's a lot of other things going on in the world, obviously, but that it's been the efforts to try to raise awareness about Parkinson's have been working.
Yeah, well, it was a big year. I mean, it felt big. It felt like things were going on. We had over 300 iconic landmarks and buildings light up blue for Parkinson's around the world. And so everywhere from Australia all the way over to Vancouver. So that was amazing. You know, all downtown Vancouver was lit up. We had the CN Tower. We had the Empire State Building. The old Sears Tower in Chicago. I mean, the Winnipeg Jets embraced it, and they had a puck drop from one guy with Parkinson's, and they dedicated a whole night to Parkinson's there. So, like, if we can get the hockey teams to embrace this would be amazing.
And for you, you were explaining earlier that there's always you know, action, reaction. You said your balance is okay. It's just your balance right now. That's the one thing that you need to fix.
Yeah, it's the one thing I want to sort of tighten up, you know?
Yeah.
my wife just looks at me funny because I bump into more inanimate objects today than I used to. And so I end up apologizing to like dressers and bookshelves. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Have any of the other things, because I think we talked about sort of waking up in the middle of the night and, you know, sort of I don't know if it was night terrors, but certainly wake up in the middle of the night and just all kinds of things that were really affecting your ability to have kind of a day-to-day, just being able to be at your best each day, right? And has a lot of that sort of started to shift a bit with this surgery?
Some of that has. So I still get very fatigued in the middle of the day, which is, they told me I would. So that's not a surprise. And they told me that it probably wouldn't help my sleep 100%. It's helped it some, but I still act out my dreams at night, because what happens is with people with Parkinson's, a lot of the times it's an early symptom, because your body's automatic systems shut down too, not just your motor symptoms. So anything that's automatic, swallowing, going to bed and being paralyzed in your sleep, your heating and your cooling, your internal thermostat goes haywire. All that stuff. And so, but I've not been sweating nearly as much. I've not been, so I would say it's probably handled 80% of all my symptoms.
And you just sharing the words from your son too, about how you have more energy. I mean, I can't imagine anything being quite as delightful to hear as that.
No, I know. Oh gosh, it's so good. We're laughing a lot now, and you know, he's 14. He's not supposed to like his parents.
True enough. True. So what do you have? What do you have planned? What next? What next? As if we're entering spring and summer, you know, you kind of got through the winter and you've recovered and this is working for you. What do you have planned? Do you have anything planned this year that you wouldn't have planned last year, for instance?
Well, I think I'm going to Helsinki to deliver a paper on Parkinson's at a conference. But I am I'm running the PD Avengers. It's my full time job, and we're looking for people that want to be PD Avengers and people who want to donate to the PD Avengers. Go to pdavengers.com. You can check it out. It's free to be a member, but if you want to donate, you can. We're going to go out there and we're going to continue to advocate. We're going to continue to make noise. And I think what we need to do is let people know we're still here every day. Every day is Parkinson's Day for me. So as long as I'm here and as long as I got a voice, I'm still going to use it.
Larry, it's great to hear from you. It's great to hear that you're doing well. Great news. And I look forward to catching up. Let's try and catch up again in the not too distant future.
For sure. Let me know next time you're around.
Indeed. Larry, again, thank you so much. I appreciate your time tonight. And I look forward to, I'll just be thinking good thoughts about you palling around with your family and feeling good.
Cool. Thanks, bud.
It felt like 1,000-ton weights had been dropped in the apartment above our apartment. And our whole room was shaking. And I said to him, Osha, what is that? And he opened the window and there was just fire in the sky. The sky lit up with their missiles and our anti-missile missiles.
Leah Appel is a Montrealer who now lives in Jerusalem. She was in her apartment, jolted from her sleep around 1:45 a.m. Sunday. Iran had just unleashed a barrage of drones and missiles at targets inside Israel, almost all of which were blocked. They either didn't reach their targets or they were shot down or intercepted. Still, it came less than 2 weeks after an airstrike blamed on Israel destroyed Iran's consulate in Syria and killed two Iranian generals. But it did mark the first time that Iran has launched a direct military assault on Israel, despite decades of animosity dating back to the country's 1979 Islamic Revolution. So the risks of escalation are clearly there. So how will Israel react? Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has been huddling with top officials to discuss a possible response. The government made no announcements on any decisions today for a second straight day. Meantime, Canada's Foreign Affairs Minister Melanie Joly says she's urging Israel to de-escalate this conflict in the Middle East, to not bomb Iran in retaliation for those airstrikes. Here's what she had to say.
Canada is pushing diplomatically to stop further escalation. And at the same time, we are still calling for a ceasefire in Gaza. It is important that hostages be released. And it is important also that aid be sent to Palestinians in Gaza.
Indeed. I mean, I don't think anyone in Jerusalem is particularly, anyone in Israel is particularly listening to Canada right now, but maybe they will listen. Maybe they're listening to the Americans. So U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says world leaders are working on a plan to prevent the escalation of tensions in the Middle East.
We have been coordinating a diplomatic response to seek to prevent escalation. Strength and wisdom need to be the same sides, the different sides of the same coin. I've been in close communication with counterparts in the region, and we will continue to do so in the hours and days ahead.
So how will Israel respond? Can they afford not to? Ali Vaez is Iran Project Director for the International Crisis Group, and he joins me now. Ali, thank you.
Great to be with you.
I suppose just to rewind about nearly 48 hours now, and just talk about, this was the first, for those who don't might not know this, this was the first time that Iran has directly attacked Israel.
Absolutely. Iran's animosity towards Israel goes back to the 1979 revolution that brought to power a revolutionary regime that one of its pillars was anti-Zionism and being against Israel. One of the first things that they did was to immediately give the Israeli de facto embassy in Tehran to the Palestinians. Mm-hmm. There's been almost 40 years of shadow war between Iran and Israel, but it had never amounted to a direct confrontation, never to a direct strike from Iranian territory on Israel proper. So this was definitely a crossing of the Rubicon and a major escalation, no doubt about it.
Interesting, though, that if from looking from the outside, there was ample warning, apparently, there, or at least there seemed to be quite a bit of warning about when and where this was going or how this was going to happen. Why would that be?
Look, because the Iranians were trying to thread a very difficult needle in the sense that they wanted to restore a degree of deterrence against Israel, but they didn't want to trigger a wider conflict and they didn't want to suck the U.S. into a direct confrontation with them. So what they did was that they signaled way in advance that they were going to do this, and they telegraphed it in direct and indirect conversations with the U.S. and U.S. allies in the region. And then even the choice of weapons that they used, for instance, they started the first opening salvo was with very slow-moving drones that would take 6 hours to get from Iran to Israel. So there was plenty of advance heads up before the attack started, which ensured that the majority of the projectiles that they sent towards Israel would be shot down. I think the Iranians were hoping that this way they could minimize casualties. They anticipated that maybe 90% of their missiles and drones would be shut down. I think they didn't expect 99% rate of success. But nevertheless, this was designed to be calibrated and measured, which is in line with what they had done in the past. You know, in 2019, there was a spectacular attack on Saudi oil facilities in Aramco, and almost half of Saudi oil was taken off the market overnight, but not a single person was injured or killed. And in 2020, Iran retaliated against U.S. killing one of its key commanders, General Soleimani, in Baghdad by firing a barrage of ballistic missiles towards the U.S. bases in Iraq. And again, no one was killed. So Iranians have developed a mastery, apparently, of this kind of, you know, a lot of sound, but not a lot of fury.
Right. And in this case, for listeners who might know where this began, this also begins with the assassination of a top commander, a top Iranian commander, ostensibly on Iranian soil, even though not in Iran, in Syria.
That's correct. So on April 1st, allegedly Israel targeted Iranian consulate in the Iranian embassy compound in Damascus, where a meeting was taking place in which two Iranian generals were participating, Revolutionary Guard commanders with decades of experience, basically, in the region. They were in charge of the logistical support of Iranian allies in the region. Iran supports non-state actors like Hezbollah in Lebanon, a lot of Shia militias in Iraq, in Syria, the Houthis in Yemen, Palestinian groups like Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad. And this general was in charge of providing them with Iranian arms and equipment. And Israel brought down the consulate building and killed those two commanders and five other Iranian Revolutionary Guards. Now, there's a pattern of Israel targeting Iranian assets and even personnel in Syria. This is not new. What was new was the fact that it happened on a diplomatic facility, which basically, based on international norms and the Vienna Convention of 1961, are supposed to be immune from foreign attacks.
Right. In other words, an attack by Israel on what was technically sovereign Iranian territory then initiates this response, which is an attack on sovereign Israeli territory. Interesting. So little damage done with these 350 some odd rockets and missiles and so on. But clearly the message was sent there. And you've mentioned earlier that one of the messages in all this was Iran now wants to de-escalate. I mean, that's essentially the idea that I'm getting, that they don't want to push this any further. This was their response to what happened a few weeks ago.
That is correct. But there's always the risk of miscalculation. Yeah. We now know that Israeli intelligence has come to the conclusion that the attack on Iranian consulate in Damascus was a miscalculation, because Israel believed as Iran was absorbing a lot of these attacks that Israel had conducted against their assets and interests in Syria without responding, that this too would not provoke Iran to respond, which now, of course, we know was a major miscalculation. And the Iranians have also calculated Israel is not going to risk an attack on Iranian soil in response to this direct Iranian attack because Israel doesn't want to engage in a multi-front war against Iran and its allies in the region, because the U.S. is going to hold Israel back. And that, too, could unfortunately prove to be a miscalculation.
Ali Vaez is senior advisor to the president and project director for Iran at the International Crisis Group. He's joining us tonight from Washington, D.C. Ali, I guess the big question now is, what will Israel's response be? Because I gather the Americans have been pretty, have been unequivocal on this, at least privately. They don't want to see this escalate any further. But there's a lot of push and pull in Israel right now for whatever this, you know, to them was a direct attack on their sovereign territory by a sworn enemy, right?
Absolutely. Look, President Biden's advice to Prime Minister Netanyahu is to take the win, because, as you said, 99% of these missiles and drones were shot down, and very little damage was done. There was just one casualty, and so in many ways, Israel, one could say, came out on the top, and there's no reason to necessarily take the risk of retaliation, which could then prompt a regional war.
And the win, because they've managed to take out these important military commanders, and this was the response to it.
Exactly. Right. But the risk here is that Israel doesn't want to set a precedent that an attack on its soil is fair game. It wants to have the last say militarily. So I think Israel is itching to figure out a way to respond. The risk here is that after the Iranian attack, the commander of the Iranian Revolutionary Guards came out and said, we have now established a new equation. In the past, we used to not respond to Israeli attacks, whether they were covert or overt. But now we're in a situation that every time Israel, from this point on, Israel targets our assets, our citizens, our interests, we will respond from our soil directly. Now, I think that is a bluff, but there are certain red lines that I don't think the Iranians can afford not to not to deliver on the threat that they've put on the table. And those two red lines are, number one, an attack on Iranian soil, and number two, any similar attack against their senior military officials, any attack aimed at decapitating their military. So those two red lines, I think, are real. And here's the risk that if Israel does something, then the Iranians, the next attack from Iran, might not be as telegraphed and as calibrated. In this attack on Saturday, Iran did not bring the tip of the spear of its regional network of alliances, which is Hezbollah in Lebanon. Hezbollah has hundreds of thousands of missiles and rockets targeting towards civilian centers in Israel. It has precision-guided missiles with which it can target critical infrastructure in Israel. And take into account that Israel is now fighting a much lesser enemy, Hamas, over the past 6 months, and has not yet succeeded in meeting all of its objectives. To fight Iran and Hezbollah at the same time would be extremely costly for Israel. And that is the calculation that I think the Netanyahu government now has to deal with. That on the one hand, it cannot afford not to respond, but on the other hand, it also cannot afford to respond in a way that triggers a regional war. And President Biden has also warned them against any kind of offensive action that would trigger that kind of regional war. The U.S. will continue to defend Israel, but if Israel wants to go on the offense, it is on its own.
I think, as you mentioned earlier, what is disturbing about this is that it has introduced a new paradigm to this long, long fight between these two countries. And that is the idea that Iran has attacked Israel directly. And then Israel has to weigh that into their calculations now. And when we get there, everything starts to get a little uneasy again.
That's absolutely right. But again, take into account that this wasn't unprovoked, that Israel pushed Iran a bit too far and therefore invited this kind of Iranian retaliation. And some believe that Prime Minister Netanyahu who is in a difficult situation politically, would benefit from anything that would prolong the crisis in the conflict in Gaza or would expand the war. But again, this comes at a massive price, not just for Israel, by the way. If we end up in a all-out regional war, the U.S. has troops and military presence in the region that is completely in the range of Iranian missiles and rockets and drones. So this is going to be extremely costly, not just for Iran and Israel and the U.S., but also the entire region and the world economy.
Right. Indeed. What will you be looking out for next? I guess the ball is very much in Israel's court now.
It is. And I don't think we can see the same kind of advanced notice and messaging that Iran engaged in prior to the attack in against Israel. And also the U.S. cannot necessarily play the same role, because the U.S. could simultaneously try to deter Iran and defend Israel. It cannot defend Iran and deter Israel. And so there are less restraint on these tensions spiraling out of control. The real milestone that we should look for is what the Netanyahu government decides to do. And there's a lot of anticipation that a counterstrike will come sooner rather than later. But again, I think the consequences of that could potentially be catastrophic.
Ali, thank you so much.
Great pleasure.
They got identity cards, national identity cards from them, indicating whether you are Hutu or Tutsi. And they were all made, all those who were supposed to be Tutsi, were seated in one line. And then they killed about 10 people.
Those are words from back in 1994 during the Rwandan genocide. I mean, if you think back to what happened in that African country in 1994, it's almost hard to imagine. But more than 800,000 Rwandans, 800,000, nearly a million, most of them Tutsis and moderate Hutus, were slaughtered by the Rwandan military and Hutu militia in just 100 days. And it marks 30 years since that horrific event. It was Canadian General Roméo Dallaire who was leading the United Nations peacekeeping mission in that African nation when the violence erupted following the shooting down of an airplane carrying Rwanda's president on April 6th, 1994. But as he's talked about often, including in his book, Shake Hands with the Devil, he stood powerless as the slaughter started, trying to raise the alarm, trying to get someone to step in. It never happened. Dallaire has called the UN assistance mission for Rwanda that he led a, quote, failure for not being able to stop the genocide, largely due to interference from the US and other UN Security Council members, he says. And the importance now, he believes, is never to forget what happened then, to who and why the world turned its back on so many people, allowing them to be slaughtered in such little time.
We cannot let the genocide die. It must remain a focal point of humanity and its failings that can go so catastrophic when people simply do not care. And we will not permit humanity to set up a pecking order where some humans are not as significant or as human as others.
Roméo Dallaire there, speaking on a previous anniversary of the Rwandan genocide. His time in Rwanda is something that he's spoken very publicly about the impact it had on him, about the long-lasting struggles that he had coming to terms with what he had witnessed, what he couldn't stop. And it forms the foundation of a new book that he's written called The Peace, A Warrior's Journey. It charts his journey all the way back to his military training at the height of the Cold War, to witnessing Rwanda descend into genocide and that no one came to help, and the decades since that he spent both struggling with what he saw and the memories he carried, as well as trying to find answers to make sure that it never happens again. The new book feels like he is, in some senses, closing a chapter on that time in some ways, putting down what he's learned both in learning the lessons of that time 30 years ago, but also looking at what hasn't worked since then. How the doctrines of responsibility to protect and the will to intervene, for instance, have been quashed because power politics, national self-interest, and general indifference that had allowed the genocide in Rwanda to unfold unchecked continue. So he's decided in this book to not only look at what happened then, but to also chart a path for peace as he sees it, having seen what he saw. and retired Lieutenant General and former Canadian Senator Romeo Dallaire, author of a new book called The Peace, joins me now. Thank you for your time tonight.
Happy to do so.
The basis of this book, so much about this book begins with what happened 30 years ago to Rwanda, to Rwandans, and to you. And maybe as we sort of mark 30 years this month since those atrocities began, perhaps just your thoughts on where we stand 30 years later, because it feels like it's so far away in time now, and yet in so many ways, it could be today's news.
Well, in fact, it is today's news, because we've repeated internationally, we've repeated the same reaction to the Rwandan genocide as we have to both, as an example, Ukraine and even Gaza, because at that time, nobody came and nobody was ready to commit to try to prevent, let alone stop the catastrophic failure. And what we're seeing now is that nobody really wants to go in and really want to establish a position that can be worked on from the ground inside. And we're the only positive thing is that now at least we're throwing ammunition to the people who are dying in Ukraine, because we wimped out in front of Putin's threat of tactical nukes. And in Gaza, we're just watching the genocide keep on going.
It's remarkable to think, if you go back 30 years to Rwanda, and of course we've actually talked about this years ago in Ottawa when you were a senator, but the helplessness and sort of the way that how quickly we walked away from our words to protect was one of the things that I think you've always talked about and has always stuck with people who remember that time quite vividly.
Well done, Ben. Yes, remember Canada has been ebbing as an influence in the world, but it did push strongly to establish the concept of responsibility to protect, which essentially said that the individual is sovereign. And as such, when there's massive abuses of human rights in a country, we have a responsibility to go in. And so we tried it in Libya and it was a mess. They really screwed it up. And so because they went too far and there was no control by the Security Council on that. And so people have been worried and, in fact, absolutely non-desirous of engaging in applying what is a convention that the UN has established. And so in so doing, what we're seeing is a lack of a will to intervene. We're seeing self-interest dominating, and we're seeing the same rhetoric as we have in the past by the political elites, by the much less innovative diplomatic corps, in as much as we're trying to work out a truce so that we can stop the fighting. But no one is talking about lasting peace. And in fact, what has happened as an example in Gaza is that we've guaranteed generational wars to come for a long time, because the kids were seeing that in real time, living it on the ground, and others watching it are actually going to be significantly influenced by, in fact, the ability of people with power to abuse it.
Interesting, because, I mean, of course, the situation in Gaza and what happened on October the 7th is all very controversial and complex, and I'm, you know this as well as anyone. Where do you come from on that? Because when one uses the word genocide in Gaza, it becomes very charged, as you well understand. But through what lens are you watching that unfold to explain that position?
My first overarching position is one of disgust. Disgust that the Middle East has continued to fiddle in the way it is attempting to establish an atmosphere of security and permitting a play of political power in that region, particularly inside Israel, that sort of leads to confrontation. So that's my first position. In regards to what Hamas did, what the Israelis are doing, if you are throwing out the window conventions that we have established and what we've worked hard at establishing in the protection of civilians, in international human rights law, and flinging it because you're giving orders like you will destroy. Well, when a commander gets a term like that, that leaves him a lot or her a lot of room to maneuver. And so when both sides are articulating that type of talk, you don't see anybody really trying to pull all that down to a sort of a lasting peace solution. On the contrary, all you're seeing is people trying to maneuver to whatever the end state might be reasonable in regards to the stopping of the killing, at least. And the use of genocide, the term genocide, is absolutely useless. It was useless in Rwanda, and it's proven to be useless right now. It might be helpful in international tribunals afterwards. I'm not going to negate that. But genocide says we intervene, and nobody is doing that.
For someone who's witnessed that up close, I think that's what's always lost. When someone sitting at home in Canada watches what happened in Mariupol, when someone in Canada's, you know, watches what happened in Rwanda 30 years ago, it's very hard, I think, to actually imagine what's happening, to see yourself in those people. And I think that's what your book begins to point out, because you watched it firsthand and then struggled to try to comprehend what you'd seen for many, many years.
Watched it, tasted it, smelled it, felt it, walked in it, and nobody came, because nobody felt it was in their self-interest, nor was worth the risk of engaging in what they very easily called tribalism. Well, when you look at how the conflicts are going on today, you can add Myanmar to that and a number of other places, you're seeing that there is still not a fundamental premise out there in the political elites of the world who are essential, because we need politicians and it's a noble profession, but there is no ability for them to rise into statesmanship, where the hubris is put aside, where innovative solutions and patience and an ability to sustain the effort of trying to bring about not only a truce, but actually push the system so that the frictions of the differences that create this rage will actually attenuate and not regenerate into the future. That is not in the world, and it's not in the world because, in my humble opinion, the world is run on organizations, on systems of governance, on institutions that were created by men who have strong egos, hubris, and misogyny, certainly. And right. So keeping the women out of all this is ensuring that we will never see a real new generation of solutions coming to this era of complex and ambiguous scenarios of imploding nations and failing states.
Retired Lieutenant General Romeo Dallaire is with me this half hour. His new book is called The Peace, A Warrior's Journey. Mr. Dallaire, I was really interested to see that part of the inspiration for this book was very personal, that you had spent many, many years trying to work your way through that time in 1994, and that manifested itself in trying to do a little bit of everything. And then you decided that you sort of came to peace through a personal situation. You found love, which is great. And that you've decided now to try and see what might be on the other side of all this. And that is your last section of the book, which is essentially called Peace.
Well, in fact, what happened is that there was a transformation over the years after I finished my first three books, which were more operational and tactical. I was trying to look at a strategic perspective of where all this stuff goes. And so I was aiming at mostly how do we prevent conflict? And I was involved with Kofi Annan's international body with Desmond Tutu to look at the prevention of genocide. So I'm into this prevention, yet all of a sudden realized that that's not enough. Why do we have the wars to start with? Why do we have the conflicts? Why do we let them get out of the situations, get out of hand that create these conflicts? And by the by, look at all the civilians and innocent civilians who are, in fact, both the prize and the targets for much of this. And it's there that I realized that the aim is to move us away from a constant return to try to find temporary solutions through these truces, because we've not seen peace, real peace. No, we haven't. We haven't really seen human security yet. And say, what do we need to go through, as Dante did, that sort of ring of fire to be able to project into a new way of advancing humanity, in order that both humanity, in concert with the planet, be able to move us to not one of survival, but one, in fact, of thriving. And ultimately, now that we can talk to everybody in the world, why can't we bring all this together and maximize the potential of humanity and this planet and move beyond it?
It's interesting because you talk about a time when you were first appointed to the mission in Rwanda, trying to figure out Rwanda because there was so little information available. I suppose in 2024, the one thing we cannot plead is ignorance.
Ben, this is why when you ask that question, you know, what do you think of it today? That's why I hold the leadership of the world, the political elites of the world, the institutions that are supposed to be there to look at and anticipate some of this stuff and to bring us away from security based on the use of power and the increase in the use of the threat of nuclear weapons and modernizing and all that time, at the same time that we're saying we got to save the planet. The hypocrisy of our era. We've seen the lessons. We are more accountable now.
What is Canada's place in all this? Because I know you've said it. You're sick of listening to people tell you that Canada talks big and walks small. Where do you think Canada has a role in what you're advocating?
I think that Canada has lost its ability to project the extraordinary potential of a nation, of a, not only one of the most stable democracies in the world, but a country that has the values and the profound belief in human beings and the rights of individuals and the human dimension of wanting to advance into the future. And so with the sweat and tears and blood of the past, we did lead. We did lead. We were one of the big players in World War II. That was our high point of our potential, at both in the field and also in industry and in production. The 50s, the 60s, the 70s, we were innovating. We were introducing leading middle power. That's what we were. But we've been riding the coattails of the big boys because we're risk adverse. We are self-interest. We've turned inward. And as one minister was telling me when I was a senator, he said, you know, why should I invest in military and in diplomatic corps and all that? He says, it doesn't give me any votes. It doesn't, because we've turned our own people inward versus realizing the extraordinary potential that this country has, not only to handle itself internally, but to project the values and the strengths and the potential of this country internationally.
Mr. Dallaire, as always, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Well, you've got the restrained version today.
The FBI opened a criminal investigation into the Francis Scott Key Bridge collapse. The Washington Post reports the FBI is investigating whether the crew of the Dolly left the port knowing the vessel had systems problems. Authorities are also reportedly reviewing the events leading up to when the Dolly slammed into one of the Francis Scott Key Bridge's support pillars.
There you have it. We found out today that federal authorities have launched a criminal investigation into last month's ship crash that destroyed Baltimore's Francis Scott Key Bridge and killed six people, all members of a construction crew that were doing road work on the bridge at the time. Of course, it could have been much worse. They did manage to, thanks to a warning from the bridge of the boat itself, they managed to, of the Dolly it's called, they managed to stop traffic, right? It could have been much worse, even though it happened right in the middle of the night. So they're going to try and find out. The FBI and the U.S. Coast Guard are leading the investigation into the disaster and whether the crew failed to report an earlier issue with the vessel that delayed its departure, apparently. So more on that as we find out. If you remember back, it's been nearly 3 weeks. It'll be 3 weeks tomorrow, I gather, that the Key Bridge collapsed around 1:30 in the morning after that massive cargo ship called the Dali lost power and struck the structure, sending thousands, tens of thousands of tons of steel and concrete into the river below. As I mentioned, six construction workers who were doing roadwork on the bridge were killed that night. The bodies of four of them have been recovered. Three have been recovered. Three are still missing, I believe. That is, crews from federal and state agencies are trying to get everything cleaned up and moved out of that shipping channel to try and get it reopened so that larger ships can make their way in and out of the port of Baltimore. As we talked about at the time, it's not one of the biggest ports in America. I think it's ninth, but it is particularly important for certain things, especially for moving vehicles. It's the biggest place for cars going in and out of the U.S., coal, amongst other things. It is a very complicated undertaking trying to clean up that much debris in that kind of environment. The water is murky, it's muddy, it's hard to see. They need to send down divers to do a lot of the work. Part of that bridge structure landed on the ship itself. So they have to figure out how to get rid of that, how to move the ship, get the containers off it. It is a ton of work. But Colonel Esty Pinchasson is with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers in Baltimore, and she joins me now. Thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
A lot of Canadians, I think, witnessed the collapse of the bridge, which happened in just a matter of seconds, really. But the cleanup feels like such a major, major, major undertaking.
It really is. I think that when you think about what it all entails, you've got these three major efforts going on simultaneously. We've got the Federal Navigation Channel, or the 50-foot channel. You might hear it being referred to as the shipping channel. That's the main artery that goes into the port of Baltimore. So all the commercial traffic that needs to resume, you've got that effort. Then you have the vessel itself, which has a different salvor working that. And then you've got the area outside the channel, which is the responsibility of the state. So you've got three efforts going on that need to be integrated and synchronized so they don't conflict with each other or actually hinder any progress because of the safety precautions that are involved.
Right. Tell me a bit about your work then, because I gather it's about 5,000 tons of steel and concrete that ended up in the river. And I gather it's pretty challenging with trying to get the steel out of the mud and so on. There's a lot of things at play. What are you responsible for?
So, well, actually, it's a lot more. One of the spans, that's the one that's laying on top of the vessel that's heading into the channel, that span alone, we think, is about 5,000 tons.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So it's pretty significant. The Corps of Engineers maintains these federal channels throughout our country. My district is responsible for about 90 federal channels. This is just one of them that we maintain at the authorized depth. So it was when we all sprung together this way, there was kind of muscle memory from 2 years ago. You might remember that there was another vessel that ran aground in the Chesapeake Bay. It was called the Ever Forward. So the same team was able to come together. These are state and federal partners that work together on a daily basis. So coming together this way to tackle such a challenge was very helpful, that we didn't have the learning curve of figuring out who's who. From my team, we have our navigation and debris removal personnel, all the surveying that we do to support that operation, but this far exceeds our capability. So what we did was bring in the U.S. Navy's salvage experts, the supervisor of salvage, SUPSALV, you might hear that acronym being used. And we were able to leverage their capability to not only help us clear the channel, but also serve as a coordinating capability across the entire waterway. But what was established here through our incident management system is a unified command. And it's a very different type of organizational structure that we employ for situations like this, where with a partnership, with the Coast Guard, the Corps of Engineers, the state, the Maryland State Police, and also the responsible, the qualified individual from the vessel, all coming together in this unified command structure, we're able to leverage all of our authorities and create a unified effort. So it's really unique, definitely a different way than I'm used to, with a very clear chain of command, very clear decision-making process that's quite regimented, and to have such a powerful organization with much more kind of agility and ability to bring in expertise and allow these authorities to meld together this way is just amazing.
Tell me a bit about the work at hand then, because I think what people are really curious about is, how do you take that much steel and concrete and everything else that plunged? How do you get it out of there?
So we brought in the largest crane on the East Coast, the Chesapeake 1000, or the Chessie 1000. We're going to have to cut some of these spans into bite-sized pieces, and these bite-sized pieces are several hundred tons each. But there are portions of the wreckage that aren't intact. The structural integrity is completely demolished. It's collapsed on itself and mangled. So you have portions of the wreckage that are not cuttable. And so we're going to have to use other types of equipment, like a grabber or a salvage bucket, to lift that wreckage out of the water. But the way that we're handling it is, we are bringing in a team. We brought in a team and the assets, expertise, and equipment that is able to handle this type of work. It's just really complex, because it's not a bridge or not just a vessel. It's both. And then you've got the power lines, and you've got the utilities under the vessel. You've got all these different constraints that we're working through. But the team is rising to the challenge. We've got the absolute best team that we possibly could here.
Yeah. Tell me a bit about the vessel itself, because I think part of the issue here is that it's still there, right? There are still containers on it, or there were, or fewer now, I think. But it's also sort of in the way. So you have to try and move it out of the way as you continue this process as well.
So the vessel actually ran into one of the piers of the bridge, which is the far side of the 50-foot channel. So it's actually running across, like, along the side of the channel, and only about 75 feet in. So the vessel itself is about 158 feet wide. The channel width is 700 feet wide. So that kind of intrusion into the channel on the south side of 75 feet, in and of itself, wouldn't be a hindrance. It was kind of like 2 years ago with the Ever Forward being outside of the channel, and you still were able to traffic vessels through. One of the differences here, though, is that the vessel isn't hard aground, where it's really pinned right now from the wreckage up against what's remaining of that pier. So it's pinned in the front at the bow, and we've had to secure it in the back with anchors so that it can be stable as we're working through clearing the wreckage. The vessel had about 4,700 containers on it. More than half of them are empty, actually. Okay. So the team right now is working to remove about 160 containers. They're creating a work area on the vessel to ensure that they can prepare the vessel for refloating. There's a very detailed refloating sequence that they're going through. We're so thankful that the hull is intact. That was a huge blessing and relief. Any hazmat that you might have heard of is contained. It was mostly soap and perfume and resin. We've got boom all the way around the vessel, so anything that could happen would be contained and managed. So we've got a long way to go. It feels like a long way to go, although it's in our minds, it's really only weeks now. But the team is really, you know, working on all cylinders. They are coordinating and deconflicting with each other. They're able to share assets across all three salvers to use the right tool for the right part of the mission. And what gives me comfort as a leader is watching them share lessons learned immediately, where you might have the state salver conducting their first lift, which came out of the ground just days after we shifted to salvage operations, and then sharing how the lift would have members falling off because the connections were impacted from the fall. So right. These lessons that they're taking daily are reviewed and being applied. I can't say enough about how great it is to see the focus on safety. We don't want to have any more casualties on this site.
Colonel S.D. Pachacet is with us from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers this half hour, Baltimore District. They've been hard at work, along with many others, by the way. This has been a team effort trying to basically fix or find and pull out the wreckage of the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore, which you may remember, you will have seen, collapsed on March the 26th. Colonel Pachacet, when it comes to the, I know there are those, there are still bodies missing. I gather that's part of the overall process, maybe not yours exactly, but part of the overall process to find those three remaining people that have been still missing since March 26th?
Yeah, Ben, so thank you for bringing that up. You know, we know that we started out immediately supporting the search and rescue operations here with our survey teams out of the Baltimore District, as well as structural engineers that were supporting the Maryland State Divers and making sure that with their urban search and rescue experience, they were able to assess the structural configuration of the wreckage and make sure that divers were going into a place that was going to be safe. But by the end of that day, when we realized we weren't going to be conducting a rescue operation, it was going to be more recovery. As that shifted, we knew that from this point on, we were going to be perpetually in recovery until we found any of the missing persons. So after a day of recovery operations, we shifted into salvage operations, where you might hear so much about the complexity of the wreckage and all that it takes to have divers go in the water and how they're being guided with 3D sonar and the visibility challenges, the unforgiving environment that they're in at the bottom of the riverbed. But what's really important to remember is that throughout all of this, if there are any signs at all of an area that may have a shred of a chance of finding human remains or something that needs to be investigated further to confirm whether or not we can recover any of the missing, we have a plan in place where the Maryland State Divers are at the ready, kind of on a hot standby to come right in and conduct that recovery operation as part of our salvage plan. It is an integrated part of our overarching salvage plan. It's not an afterthought. So as every layer of wreckage is being peeled back and the teams are going in to assess how the wreckage reacted, did anything change stability-wise, they're not just looking at the members of the trusses that are sitting there and buried. They're also looking to see if there are any signs of any of missing persons or any indications where we need to investigate further. It's so hard because I know the teams think about the families that just had to celebrate Easter or not celebrate Easter
Mark
with
Easter,
their
yeah.
loved ones.
Yeah.
And knowing that those families that don't have closure yet are out there, and it's very fresh on everyone's minds because it's so close. This team that's working in Baltimore, this is our port. This is our community. It's our city. Knowing that these families are out there, we talk about that every single day, knowing that this is a part of it. Now, two Fridays ago, we actually had an opportunity to exercise this plan. And there was an indication from within the dive survey that there was potential for finding a vehicle with a missing person inside. And so right away, the divers were on the scene and they were able to recover this person and give closure to one of the four missing people. So right. it's not just a plan that's out there ready to go. We've actually exercised it and proved that it works. So I feel really confident that every step of the way, we're truly being just responsible and thorough.
Right.
Really proud of the team.
Delicate in every which way, of course, right, as you point out. I suppose there is, all that being said, too, there is still a timeline you're trying to meet. They, you know, clearly for the health of the port and so on, they want this shipping channel. People want this shipping channel open as fast as possible. You're saying now by the end of the month, potentially, there could be more open, and which will allow for more traffic?
Right. So we did establish a few temporary channels. Right now we have an 11-foot channel to the north of the main channel and then a 14-foot channel to the south. And that'll basically allow for barges and tugs to come through, possibly recreational vessels that have been waiting to either leave or come and go from in and around Baltimore. But what we're really trying to establish is what we're calling a limited access channel. It's going to be about 280, 300 feet wide and 35 feet deep. So yesterday we had a pretty exciting day where we removed 440 tons, one big section of the span that is the furthest away from the vessel. If you can imagine the channel and the vessel is on the south side, there is a large span that's about 1,500 tons across from that one pier. So the span across from the vessel is about 1,500 tons, and we had a huge successful lift yesterday, lifting about 440 tons of this section out of the water. But we were able to remove the concrete happened by us having to basically cut through that span and dig down below the mudline to expose the bottom cords of that truss. Work took place. It allowed for the concrete roadway to settle on the bottom and fall off of the truss. So we didn't have to lift that up, and we were able to then transport it using the Chesapeake 1000 all the way over to the laydown area. So that was a very big win. We're going to go back in and remove the rest of that concrete from the bottom of the riverbed. So eventually when the channel is completely clear, you'll have a nice empty hazard-free channel for future vessels to come through.
Yeah. Where's all this stuff going? Where are you bringing all this stuff once it gets moved
down? It's going down to a lay down area at Sparrows Point.
Okay.
Still within the Baltimore channel area. And it's owned by Trade Point Atlantic, who is redeveloping the Bethlehem Steel area. And it's just a great, great win to be so close. And Skanska set up tremendous, basically like a salvage yard where all this material is being deposited and then processed, broken down, and eventually will be transported to a final location. Things are being recycled and sold off to scrap metal. It's just going to be just another detail of this much larger plan.
Right.
The span that they had to break up, that large span, what they had to do in order to secure that and the rigging that they do in order to lift this up, the rigging can take a week just to, from the calculations that they make to lift it up, to be balanced, figuring out where the center of gravity is and how not to compromise the crane operators that are working on these vessels. Just it's a humbling thing to see, just because it does seem like for us almost insurmountable, but they do it. They're able to take this apart and very methodically with each evolution in a very disciplined approach. It's just remarkable.
Well, Colonel Pachassin, thank you so much. Good luck.
Oh, thank you so much, Ben. Really appreciate being able to share our story.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone, like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.